Okay, welcome to Better World Forum 2012. Thank you. We have Stephen J. Zuckerman on the line, the co-producer, with me, Rick Ulfick, and we're very excited to welcome our guest for this session named Dr. Shan Turnbull, and his work is called Transforming Finance from the Ground Up. And we're very excited that Shan is calling us from Sydney, Australia, live. So welcome to the forum.
Thank you, Vic.
Shan, I'd like to introduce you in a more modern way than the bio on the website, because you told me that that was an older bio, so let's prepare people with a new listening. Dr. Shan Turnbull is a prolific author on reforming theories and practices of capitalism that a Google search can identify. After obtaining an MBA from Harvard, he became a private equity partner, reorganizing public companies, and also a serial entrepreneur, listing three companies on the Australian Stock Exchange. In 1975, he co-founded the first course in the world to provide company directors an educational qualification and wrote Democratizing the Wealth of Nations. The novel ideas in his book led to consulting assignments for multinational corporations, United Nations, World Bank, and governments, including in 1999, the People's Republic of China and Czechoslovakia. In the early 1980s, he represented to community activists attending E.F. Schumacher Society seminars across the U.S. his 1978 proposal for an energy currency. His presentations are published in Building Sustainable Communities, Tools and Concepts for Self-Reliant Economic Change. He is now working on introducing energy money as a member of the Green Money Working Group, sponsored by the 40 Foundation and Co-ops UK Limited. I'd like to welcome Shan to this session. Shan?
Thank you, Stephen.
Should I call you Dr. Shan?
No, just call me Shan, the man with the plan.
Okay, Shan, the man with the plan. When you first sent something to us to be part of Better World Forum, I was intrigued with what it is that you were speaking of and how you were aligned with so many very impressive people in Europe, in the UK, people that are really involved in new types of decisions that are being made. I'm fascinated with co-op and what's going on in England, and wanted to find out more. So I spent 2 days anticipating a very exhilarating conversation, and I'm glad that we connected. So now let's talk a little about, or not a little about, a lot about what it is that you're doing with this whole Green Money Working Group, and I know it's gone under some different names. Let me ask, start with a first question here. I think that in a world of interconnectedness and new types of transparency, we're seeing new solutions here for a better economic system. People seem to have a lot of power in their hands now, especially with mobile technology. Let's start by asking, how do you define money? How is that defined?
Well, money is really not defined except by governments. And money can be anything throughout the last couple of thousand years. Many things have been used as money. It's a convenience. And governments define what money is, and they create a national monopoly of defining what money is for them, and they call it legal tender. So there's really no definite answer to your question. I mean, economists talk about, they have definitions of what it's supposed to do, like being a medium of exchange to avoid bartering, to be a measure of value, and so on. But by asking what money is and finding out that governments define legal tender what money is, it raises a much bigger question. Is if governments define what money is and so can create it, why do they borrow it? Now, this is what all your...
No, you ask that question one more time. If they define it, can you state that one more time?
If they define what is money in their national territories, they are the only ones who have the power to define what money is and so have the power to create it. So if governments can create money, why do they borrow something that they can create? Now, this is what people should be asking.
And what is your answer to that?
We've got a back-to-front financial system. We've got money created by governments at the top instead of people who create wealth at the bottom. We need to reverse it. Instead of the private sector creating money and lending it to the government should be creating money and lending it to the private sector. It's just a ridiculous, indefendable system of finance we have. Now, what we need is people to ask these questions of their economics teachers, of their bankers, of their gurus, of their politicians. Why is it that governments borrow money instead of creating it? And the wise men will say, oh, if governments created money, you'd get inflation. Well, why do you think it would get more inflation with governments creating it than with the bankers creating it? I mean, the bankers got a profit motive to create it. They're driven by profits. And then you've got to have governments to regulate the bankers. And if the bankers create the money and lend it to the government's got to pay the interest on the loans. And where does the government get the money to pay the interest, to pay the bankers? It taxes people. So much of the U.S. budget is to pay the taxes it raises is to pay its national debt. It should be the other way around. The government should be lending money to the banks so the banks can pay interest to the government and so people pay less tax. Does that make common sense?
It is. It does make sense. After we discuss all these aspects, another discussion is how can we change things around?
From the bottom up. Power for the people.
Okay.
And over the last 10 to 20 years, there's been all sorts of initiatives from the bottom up, just like the Green Movement. It happens spontaneously around the world. There's no sort of central authority. Nature has no central authority. There's no central authority there's no chief executive neuron in your brain. The way nature operates is decentralization. By that way, you get resiliency, you get redundancy, and the power to reproduce through your DNA for generations. At the moment, we've got an economic system that has got a cancer, having more and more debt, creating more and more interest costs, and then needing to manufacture more money to pay the interest we're creating. It's just unsustainable. It's just we're going to have the mother of all financial crashes in the foreseeable future. But to answer your question, how do we get around this? It's not going to happen from the top down.
Of course not.
Because you know, it's like sitting on a branch and cutting off the tree. It's not in anybody's self-interest to change the system from the top down. The change has got to come from the bottom up. And you can play a valuable role in getting the message out to people to be self-reliant and take the initiative from the bottom up. Now, who should create money and credit? Well, it certainly shouldn't be the banks, because they're motivated by profit. A better solution, but a second best, is the government, because then you've got to make sure that they don't create too much. But they have independent central banks that are independent of the government, so they could be put in charge of creating it, beside controlling the interest rates. And anyway, we shouldn't have interest rates, but that's another topic. The people that should be creating money are those who create wealth. Now, the people that create wealth are the 99% of the workers and the few investors. Wealth is created from the bottom. So it's those who buy and sell things, trade, have things to trade and to produce. That's where money should be created, at the bottom. The trouble is getting credibility for creating money from the bottom up. And that needs some sort of third-party insurance. You need people to insure people creating credit. Anybody can create credit. I mean, if I sell you my book for $10, I might say to you, Stephen, look, I'll give you 30 or 60 days to pay me. So I've created credit by selling my book to you. The problem is your IOU to me mightn't have much credibility, so you need somebody to guarantee your credibility. And you need credit insurance, in other words. So it's not banks we need. It's somebody to insure the credit that we create ourselves at the bottom, that we've got credibility. And that IOU can then be negotiable and handed round as hand-to-hand money or deposited in banks. So that's the answer of where we should be creating money from the bottom up.
How does renewable energy fit into this idea of green money?
Well, if we wanted to have a contract for, say, to send your children to school in 10 years' time, and you've got some money and you have value somewhere in your house, or you have something of value, and you want to have a 10-year contract, now what would you have faith in 10 years' time that would maintain its value? Would a bar of gold be useful for your children's education? No, bar of gold doesn't educate people. It's heavy and needs cost of storage and insurance. Would you want to use U.S. dollars to invest your valuables in? Well, 10 years' time, the U.S. dollar could well be inflated away. There's no other way the American government can get out of its debt except by debasing its money. Would you want to invest it in euros? Same problem. Euros mightn't exist in a year or two's time. So what do you have confidence in that would maintain its value in 10 years' time? And the answer is modern societies need to have energy. And energy which doesn't require fuel and so expenses is renewable energy. So the kilowatt hours of electricity is a very useful unit of standard of value. And if the generators are cooperatively owned, so there's no profit excess profit motive, cooperatives, if it's cooperatively owned, and cooperatives are for profit organizations, but they're mutual organizations. So if the generators are cooperatively owned and are generating electricity, you'd have a great degree of confidence that the value of a kilowatt hour in 10 years' time will be minimum and will not change or inflate. So you've got a standard unit of value, and that's what I call, if it meets those tests from benign renewable energy sources, that creates green money. But green money has other properties. We've got to ask, what's wrong with the present money we have? Well, the present money just cannot be defined, as I said in my opening remarks. Present money is not anchored to anything real. Now, money determines prices and costs, and you have this ideology that markets are efficient. But efficient in what terms? Because money's not related to reality. You cannot define, it cannot be redeemed into anything specific. It's no longer redeemable into gold, silver, tobacco, slaves, or women, like it used to be in for thousands of years in the past. It is a belief system. It's like a religion. It just depends upon belief. And so values and costs and prices are not anchored in the environment. And we need to connect the financial system and financial markets to the services of nature. And renewable energy is a service of nature. There's no limits to it, but you use it or lose it, and it provides you a unit of value which you can have belief in much more confidently than national funny money currencies. Now, another problem of money created out of nothing is that we give it an interest rate. Well, this is unconscionable and undefendable. Why should a social construct or make-believe thing called money increase as the clock ticks when nothing may be happening in the real world? Why should banks create money and then add an interest rate to it when it doesn't cost them hardly anything to create the money in the first place? So money which increases in value as the clock ticks is unsustainable.
What is that word? I didn't. You said acroptics?
At the clock. The clock. Tick-tock.
As the clock ticks. Sorry. I didn't get that.
As the clock ticks, why should money increase in value as the clock ticks?
Right.
Just as the time passes.
Right, I get it.
When it's not affecting, there's no connection between the money and the environment and the real world. So we've created a rod for our own back. We've created a treadmill. So as the interest rates compounds, ever increases, compounding upwards, we've got to print more money to pay the interest. It's just an indefendable system. Now, for thousands of years, when we had what I call natural money, or money which was a commodity, like grain, or tea or tobacco, those sort of commodities all deteriorated with time. So there's a cost in having money. The 3,000 years ago, money was grain. You put the grain in the store warehouse, and you're given a receipt for it. So you deposit grain in the storehouse. The grain would depreciate, or what is called rusting money. And so you need money to follow the laws of nature to depreciate. And we've got the opposite sort of money. And so we've got an unsustainable sort. Another problem with the money we have, it's centrally created by central banks and a little bit by government. I mean, what people listening in here ought to ask their bankers and economists, how much money is there is? And he'll say, there's three sorts of money. There's coins, which everybody's familiar with, and notes. And then there's deposits at banks. Now, the economists and bankers will tell you that if the total money in a nation, only about 3% is notes and coins. Now, that's the money the government creates. All the other money, the deposits of banks create. And a lot of people just do not get it. They do not believe that banks create money.
That's an interesting question. Are you talking about leverage? When you say banks create money, in other words, they have a certain amount of money that let's say their depositors and others have put in, but then they can kind of use that to
modify.
To multiply. And is it that multiplication that you're talking about when you say create money?
It's they call it the bank multiplier.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, there's only 3% of money created by the government, and now that 3% doesn't have an interest rate. Your coins and your notes do not earn interest, but the money in banks does earn interest. And if the government wants money, instead of creating money like it does notes and coins, it could create deposits and sell those to the banks. That's how you could reverse the system. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. So we've got to wait for the mother of all financial crises and the breakdown and make sure that people are educated enough not to let the government to rebuild the system like it was before. We have so many times when we have a crisis and a breakdown that the system is rebuilt in the model or the template of what existed before. And that's what's created the problem. So we've got to build the financial system literally from the ground up, from renewable services of nature, so the environment can control the global population. The carrying capacity of the plague of people on the planet is determined by the service of nature to service it with renewable energy. And if we want to sustain humanity on the planet, we need a new sort of We need markets to allocate resources, and that's people. People are resources, to spread them around the planet according to how well the environment can sustain this quality of life. And the quality of life very much depends upon energy consumption in modern societies. Now, a lot of economists will say, you need gold, you need silver, you need a basket of commodities. Well, every part of the global environment is different. Some parts of Some bioregions have gold, some don't. People say, oh, you need to get a basket of commodities. But who defines the basket? What are the politics of deciding what's in the basket and what's not? Who's to say what's an average consumption of commodities? They change with technology. They change with where you live in the globe. And so there's no one good solution. There's just solutions which are better compromise. And renewable energy seems to be the best compromise as a way of anchoring prices, values, and costs to the real world of the environment and its ability to sustain humanity on the planet. Does that sort of make sense to you?
It's getting there. It's new territory for me thinking in this way. I want to come back to the connection to renewable energy, but there was something that I heard about recently, listening to a professor of economics named Richard Wolff on WBAI Pacifica Radio.
Yes, I've met him.
Oh, you know him? Okay. Well, he gave an interesting example a few days ago about a bank, and I believe he said it was the state of Nebraska. I could be wrong about it. It might be North Dakota or one of those states. I forget exactly which state, but there's a state that has a bank. It's a national, it's a state-run bank, and the bank apparently it does some unique things. It's very different from other banks, and it actually returns whatever interest comes into it, and it returns the interest to the people of the state so that their taxes can be lowered, and it's a way of providing funding for certain things that people want in the state. I don't know if you've heard about that, but it's
interesting. In fact, while you've been talking, I've just put in Google Public Banking Institute, and I now have a map. It's chaired by Ellen Brown, who's coming to a conference my sponsors are organizing in Croatia, Split, in July. And on her webpage, it says, public banking is already works in the United States and is catching on. 17 state legislatures are now scoping it out. And it has a map of the various states where they have public banking initiatives.
And Nebraska?
I can't read it on them.
That's okay. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. But it's one of those.
That's a detail. But it's a good step to take away the profit motive from banking. It's not governments creating money, though. So the governments still go into debt. And so they still need to tax their citizens to pay interest to the bank. So it's much better for the people that create wealth to create the money.
Right.
So
well,
it's one step in the right direction.
Yeah, in this case, the state actually owns the bank, so I guess they don't have to pay interest to the bank because, right? Or
no, they probably do.
You
probably
think so?
Borrow.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I mean, the Bank of England is owned by the English government, but it borrows money from the bank instead of asking the bank to give it money.
Let me ask a question that many people ask, and more importantly, unfortunately, most people don't ask. Who owns the Federal Reserve?
The Federal Reserve banks, which are privately
owned. In the United States?
Yes, United States Federal
privately
Reserve.
Owned?
Privately owned, but government controlled. It was a scheme hatched up in, I think, 1913, by the big investment bankers at the time. They were having financial crises, and to bail them out, they had to have ad hoc lobbying with the government to bail them out every time they created too much money.
So who owns that today, other than the banks? Are there certain families that own that?
It used to be all the big, the big names of the Rothschilds and the Morgan Stanley,
Carnegie, and et cetera.
Those. I've got no idea what the ownership is now. I've tried to search it. I can't find out. but it is privately owned. And of course, in 1913, when the Federal Reserve was created, the model was, of course, the English Bank of England, which was privately owned. But they nationalized the Bank of England after World War II, so it became government-owned. But it's still, while it's government-owned, just like state banks can be government-owned, their governments then borrow money from their own banks, which is ridiculous. What they should be doing is stopping the private banks creating money and substituting government-created money, so you don't get any inflation. What you're doing is reducing the amount of money created by private banks and having the government creating it. A better way is to go back to basics, down to the transform finance from the ground up and have people creating money with credibility.
People creating money.
Yes.
People like creating our own lottery systems.
No, not lottery. If I sell you my book on credit, I've created credit. The problem is
right.
The so it's the people that...
With all, you know, we keep hearing these states are in trouble and they're bankrupt and they don't have enough money to pay their employees. What happened to all that lottery money that went into the New Jersey lottery, the New York lottery? Where does that go? Where's that gone?
I don't know. And that's a red herring, Stephen. That's a red herring asking about the lottery money. Much more, you've got to keep to the core problem of the government's failing to stop the bank, the private sector creating money instead of themselves. That's the core problem. Lottery's just a distraction. We don't want to go there.
Yeah, and lottery money is a tiny, tiny little fraction of the budgets of states.
Thank you, Rick.
Okay, I'm just wondering.
Well,
yeah,
it's a good question to ask.
Yeah, it's because we hear a lot about it, and that's like you're saying, Shan, it's a distraction. A friend of mine someone who is one of the speakers in this forum, Danny Schechter, says television is a WMD, a weapon of mass distraction.
Exactly. But it's good we have these conversations because the people listening in have got to learn what are distractions and what are the core issues, because they get flobbed off. With people saying, oh, he's talking about governments creating money, that's inflationary. Well, but it isn't inflationary if you stop the banks creating money. You're just substituting one person, a non-profit organization, a democratically elected non-profit organization to create the money instead of privately owned for-profit organizations. It must be a step in the right direction. But, you know, central banking is but a specialized sort of central planning. Central banking is like central planning, and we know that central planning doesn't work. You get all these people promoting market ideology based on central planning. It's an oxymoron. You just can't have markets with central planning, with government monopolized definition of what money is. And my members of our Green Money Working Group in England, we have the peak body, the cooperative movement, which has 10 million members. We also have the peak body of the British Chambers of Commerce, and their affiliate, their member firms, employ 5.5 million citizens. So together, our Green Money Group in the UK represents over 15.5 million citizens who are involved in small and medium-sized enterprises, the very people that should be creating the money. Now, that's 25% of the UK population. Now, that is serious political clout, and a serious political clout with people that have voted for the present government. Now, they're responsible lobby groups, both of these organizations, and they realize that there are laws against people creating their own money. But they also realize that when the mother of all financial crashes arises, that decision-making by the government is when they run out of options. And it's quite patently clear to many observers that governments and the IMF, the World Bank, and the sovereign states are running out of options. And when they run out of options, they'll change the laws. And the whole strategy we have for the Green Money Group, working group, is to have a fallback position. But when they run out of options, here's a way that you can get the economies going again from the bottom up without going into debt and without needing taxes. It's a way to stimulate economies around the world without governments going to debt or paying taxes. But to do that, they've got to change the laws.
Right. And the question is, why should they change the laws if the current laws benefit special interests?
Because there's voting clout. If they want to stay in government, they've got to do the will of the people. And we've got to empower the people to know what to ask for. And they've got to reverse the present system of creating money and reverse the present characteristics of money that grows with interest but have money which decays with time. They've got to know what to ask for. During the Great Depression, now this is very instructive. My inspiration for these ideas is, they're not my ideas, it's ideas, it's ideas that worked during the Great Depression in the 1930s when the U.S. banks stopped lending money. Hundreds of communities throughout the United States created their own local currencies with a cost, which a lot of people call a negative interest rate. It's really a cost-carrying money. It's money that which the user had to pay a fee to use the money. It's like a Tobin tax, a domestic Tobin tax. It was called stamp script, and a famous economist at the time, Irving Fisher at Yale University, published a little handbook in 1933 called Stamp Script. And if you put that in Google, and you can bring it up, you can read that little book over 3 or 4 hours, and it's an instruction book of how local communities can create their own currencies from the ground up. Now, the beauty about
yes, go ahead.
The beauty about this money.
Can you repeat that name again, please?
Stamp
Economist.
Oh, Irving Fisher.
And also, Fisher. Can you spell? Yeah, go ahead.
Irving Fisher, F-I-S-H-E-R.
And the Sanskrit. Can you spell
stamp,
that word?
S-T-A-M-P. Stamp. It's like a postage stamp.
Uh-huh.
It's like a postage stamp. And in the back of the book, he had an appendix of legislation brought into Congress in 17th of February 1933, Senator and a House of Representative Pettingill and Bankhead, Tahula Bankhead's father, Senator Bankhead.
Speaking of banks.
Yes. they introduced into Congress a bill for the U.S. government to issue $1 trillion of this stamped script. It was paper money that would circulate, but it lost all its value at the end of each week unless you bought a 2-cent stamp from the post office. And you stuck the 2-cent stamp on the back of the note. Now, so the post office would be getting 2 cents for every dollar note in circulation on $1 trillion. Well, if you get 2 cents every week, after a year, that's 52 weeks, the post office has got 104 cents, or $1.04, for every note issued. And that $1.04 is used to redeem the note after 12 months. And what that bill would have done would have injected $1 trillion into the U.S. economy without the government going into debt and without the government raising taxes to stimulate the economy. Shock, horror. It would be the post office that would be replacing the Federal Reserve. So guess what happened? Roosevelt introduced the New Deal. 14 days later, the New Deal was announced, and this bill was cast aside, and all the hundreds of initiatives down at the bottom of the on the ground in many little communities throughout the United States, they made illegal the use of this stamp script because it threatened the power of the Federal Reserve.
Uh-huh.
But it's now
there are local currencies, many local currencies. I think there are like 2,000 around the world, right? And I know there are some in New York City and New York State that I'm aware of.
Yes. Paul Glover runs the local currency in New York State, and he got the idea when he attended one of these seminars that Stephen mentioned, I was involved in the 1980s when I was working with the E.F. Schumacher Society. We had the 6-day-long seminars at different for community leaders and activists throughout the United States. We ran about 6 of them. And 2 days we spent on how to local people could create their own local currencies.
So and there's something called Ithaca Hours.
Exactly. And that's
and it seems to be based on people's service, right?
Exactly, yes. And there's about 5,000 local currencies now evolving around the world.
Well, 5,000, wow.
And there's time banks, some based on time, on people's services. And most of what they call complementary currencies are not really independent currencies because they are redeemable or define their value with the official government money. And that's partly the reason why the government allows them to exist, I suspect. What green money is quite different from any of those time banks or complementary currencies. Green money establishes an independent unit of value which is tied to the service of nature. It connects the environment with how you define values, costs, and prices. And so we have the environment being the government, the environment that determines the allocation of resources. And green money the mechanics of green money is that it makes renewable energy much more economical. And you'd find that the need for carbon taxing and trading would be diminished or not required because the unit of value is renewable energy. Burning carbon becomes less attractive if we had green money. So it's one way of solving the pollution problem of burning carbon.
Well, I'm interested to introduce you to Jeremy Rifkin, if you don't know him already. Do you know
that
name?
I quote him in my writings.
There you go. There you go. I figured, because he's involved with something called the Third Industrial Revolution, which has to do with decentralizing energy distribution and using internet technology so that people can generate electricity and energy in their own homes through wind and solar and geothermal and other things and put it back into the grid, and it can be distributed in the same way that personal computers are connected through the internet.
This is a great initiative.
And have you talked to him about kind of marrying what he's doing with what you're doing?
No, but they're symbiotic. They both reinforce each other's initiatives. And I've not made contact with him at all. But when I was working with the E.F. Schumacher Society, we had plans to put into action, and I encourage anybody listening to try and follow the example that we developed. But the president of the E.F. Schumacher Society was a dear friend of mine called Bob Swan, and they lived in Great Barrington, and they had a local ski resort there that he got permission to put a wind turbine on the top of the ski resort. And we're going to finance the wind turbine by issuing IOUs. I'll deliver kilowatt hours to you in 2, 3, 4, 5 years' time if you pay me federal funding money to me today. So we would sell these renewable energy bonds to the sinking funds of apartment houses. Apartment houses have to have sinking funds to replace the elevators and public areas that wear out. So the idea was to sell these bonds and then distribute the renewable energy through the mass electric grid. And when they invoice the apartment houses for the electricity, instead of paying in federal funding money, they could just redeem their bonds. So it's a way of establishing a reserve renewable energy unit of value. Now, we then spoke to Mass Electric about could they cooperate in redeeming our bonds instead of using federal money. And the problem back in the 1980s was the computer system. It was punch cards, and they needed another slot to identify it was a different sort of money they were using, and they didn't have enough fields left in the punch cards to identify it. So the whole initiative went away. But now we don't have that problem with the digital age. So please, I'd encourage all local communities to start financing their renewable energy by issuing energy money.
Are you connecting with some of the renewable energy utilities about this? You know, this is a growing thing. There are wind utilities and solar utilities that are starting to spring up.
I'd love to, and there are some states where they are cooperatively owned. I believe in Wyoming, they have cooperatively owned renewable power utilities. And it's those sort of organizations that green money are dependent upon, because they would define the unit of value for creating an inflation-resisting and crisis-resisting type of money, which could save the economy.
So I was wondering about how this can become implemented, you know, your system.
It's for your connections. Your connections and those listening.
Yes, exactly.
And this is the way to marshal.
Because this could be a bottom-up kind of thing that springs up in the same way that these independent energy companies are springing up, even though we're still kind of controlled by the big dinosaurs of fossil fuels and nuclear and all of that. But the small mammals of the next age are starting to spring up. So maybe that's the way to go.
Well, it would be great if you could be a catalyst in putting all this together.
Well, let's say we wanted to do that. Okay. Shen, you mentioned something to me in a dialogue a few weeks ago about some countries in Africa that had been involved with green money transformation in Africa. And this morning I had a conversation with a gentleman who lives in Kenya, and this is a conversation before the forum started early in the morning here. And he was starting to tell me something about cell phones and money and things of that nature. The question, the big picture here is, if we're talking about a new form of economics based on serving the needs of the people, what are the steps that need to happen to make that happen, to implement this?
Well, Africa, I'm glad you brought that up, because we haven't touched on the subject. And this is Africa. About 4 years ago, the United Kingdom government donated a couple million pounds to an application to design a program for cell phones to hold digital money. And 4 years ago, in Africa, where there's very few banks and very few landlines, cell phones started replacing banks. And how it worked was, it started informally. They had these cheap Chinese cell phones, you know, $10 or something, but they have the capacity of, they've got, when you buy your SIM card, which is your subscriber identification module, SIM, the SIM card would have stored value in it. Now, the stored value, it's like a debit card, and the stored value gave you so much speaking time. You might buy, you know, 10 or 20 or 50 hours speaking time. And you could transfer that stored value from one cell phone to the next cell phone. So you didn't go to a bank. It's a way of communicating value, transacting value, remitting value, independently of the banking system. And so the young workers would leave their villages, go and earn a job in the town, and instead of commuting back maybe hundreds of miles in the weekend to take the money back to their families, they'd buy a SIM card repay, add value to the existing SIM card, and transmit it to their parents. The parents would then go to the village store and transmit it to the storekeeper to buy goods. So, but there were quite considerable transaction costs.
So then, I have a question about that. How could they transmit the value if it's in a SIM card, which is a physical thing?
Oh, yes. They transmit the debit, the value, the airtime, from one SIM card to the other.
Okay.
Do you follow?
Well, if you can do that, I mean, I didn't know that you could do that.
It's a bookkeeping exercise through the from the service provider.
Right. Okay.
From the internet.
So they're acting
provider.
As the bank.
Yeah, yes. They're acting as a bank. A bank nowadays is nothing but a big computer.
Right.
And internet service providers and cell phone operators have big computers.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a disruptive technology, major disruptive technology. And
disruptive to the established order of banking.
Exactly. And so you can now, and SIM cards, there's some cell phones that can act as like a swipe card. As you go through the checkout counter, you swipe your cell phone to pay for your goods and services. Much more convenient than using money. You've got digital money nowadays. And
wow.
the program to allow these phones to operate this way was a donation from the UK government. Then the central banks of the various countries allowed them to use official money, to store official money, but they limited it to about $100. When I was in England earlier this year for our first public green money meeting, I think one of the banks in England announced they would allow people to store up to about £300 sterling in their cell phones. Now, this all is now going to escape. Soon it's going to escape the control of the government, because cell phones can store all sorts of currencies. It could be US dollars, it could be euros, it could be airtime for the cell phone, or it could be green money. So you can have a mean. Do you follow?
So are you in touch with them about that?
In touch with who?
Well, these companies.
No, I was hoping that people in Africa would tune into this this program and tell us about their experience and how it worked. Because what you're providing is a great way of sharing experiences from real live people at the ground basic level of how they use this.
The people from Africa that are a part of this have been on for a very long period of time. But remember something. Right now, it's 6:48 in New York, 6:48 p.m. In Sydney, what is it, 8:45 a.m.?
Yes.
Monday?
Yes, Monday, April
23rd. So we're 14 hours ahead. South Africa is 11:48 p.m., and Nairobi, Kenya, is 12:48 a.m. So with the conversations
right.
I've had today with these people, with the people in Africa, they're sleeping. But all this entire event is being is archived, so they'll listen tomorrow.
Right.
Well,
so you may be getting
excellent.
A call.
Well, this is excellent, because we've got to learn from each other, you know, the theory and practice. And we need more practice and stories, people telling their own stories from the ground up of how they're using their cell phones to run their economies. And some central banks have allowed this to go international. The Central Bank of the Philippines, and I think it's Dubai, where you have guest workers working in the Philippines, they can remit money directly home through, they've got a system of foreign exchange where it's all done through the cell phones and bypasses the official banking system. But again, it's limited. They've limited to minor amounts, which is a huge crack in the armor, because, you know, it provides, the technology is out there. And to get green money going, we need to have a public access technology, so it's not captured by one of the big internet companies.
I could see that, and I have an idea who to talk to. Let me ask you a question, because it's 10 minutes prior to the hour, and I wanted to open up a little bit of Q&A. I've made the phone lines available. I wanted to ask, Shen, is it possible to ask two questions now from people?
Sure.
Okay.
Delighted.
Let's go to question number one. This is Suzanne in Perth, Ontario, Canada. And I'll read you her letter verbatim. Shan, have you seen the movie Thrive, which is about banking and other systems which are no longer working and looks at free energy technology? Do you think we're going towards an age where money is no longer needed and we exchange energy through our individual gifts? Okay.
Well, thanks, Susan, for her question. No, I haven't seen that movie, but it's called Thrive. Is that what
you're saying? T-H-R-I-V-E. So maybe sometime in the next whatever period of time, you can go look up Thrive on IMDb or YouTube or something like that.
Right. Now, to answer the second question, is money needed? Yes. It's a huge convenience to have money. Markets are an efficient way of allocating resources and sorting things out on an anonymous long-distance basis. But you need markets which have prices which are related to reality. We don't have markets which are ethical or grounded in nature. We need prices, values, and costs which are tied to the capacity of the planet to support humanity to exist on a sustainable basis. So yes, money is needed. But we've got the wrong sort of money. We need to have a green type of money.
Is okay. There another question, Steve?
Yeah, there's actually three or four. This comes from Jackie Bergman in Stockholm, Sweden. And she asks, what about the need of exponential growth as long as we have private bank currencies? And can we make the present growth green?
Well, Jackie, that's a terrific question, and it's a marvelous question. We can't have exponential growth. It's just not sustainable, and that's one of the take-home messages I hope that people can get from this conversation we're having. And as long as money earns interest, you've got exponential growth. It's just not sustainable, and we can't... See, the way the orthodox economic thinking is... Oh, we've got to have economic growth. Why you got to have economic growth? To pay the extra interest costs. Well, we have limited world resources. It's just not, we've got a plague of people on the planet. We just don't have exponential potential to feed them.
This reminds me of a legalized punt. Not what you're talking about, how we're trying to pay debt with this and that and that, all the way that it's working now. It looks like a legalized Ponzi scheme in some way.
It is. The banking system is one of the biggest confidence trick in the history of civilization.
And, okay, Shane, I'm going to email you all the questions as well so you can respond to
them. Are there any other questions there?
Yes. There's someone who did not put their name on it, but it's a very good one. They're all excellent questions. Hi, I was in Kenya in 2010 and saw how M-Pesa worked. It's M-P-E-S-A.
Yes, that's the leading digital currency in Kenya, yes.
Okay. There are about 9 million users now all over the country. It exploded because it was needed, and they have small shops where these transactions can be made all over the country. Someone talked about that. We got a link from Diane in Boca regarding a link to the movie Thrive, which I will send you. And she's also asking if you have a presentation that you can send her. I'm going to send this to you in a moment, Shan, so you have this, because she'd like to know more about this for the LED lighting world.
And also, Shan, you can post things at the Better World Forum. There's a blog there. So if you... And there may be other resources, Steve, that you can talk about where some of the people who are joining the forum can post their messages. But at least you could do that to spark some conversation.
Well, that's terrific. What we
absolutely.
Need is...
There is someone who's on, because we have this live for people to call in, someone who's live on the phone. It sounds like they're shuffling cards or something.
And what's the person's name?
Oh, I don't know who it is. I don't want to accuse anyone, but if someone...
No, but I'm saying, is there... perhaps that person can speak and say the question or comment?
I'd love to have any questions come in over the phone.
But they're not...
Okay, here is another this is from Suzanne, again, up in Perth, Canada, in Ontario. So great that Shan says we need to share our stories and exchange from the ground up. Yes, we need to learn from each other. This is what is how we can empower ourselves. Also, David Suzuki says, ecology and the economy from the same root. Ecology is our home, and economy is how we take care of it. Someone is now taking responsibility for the name, not a problem. Kathy Little in Calgary is the person who responded about the M-Pesa in what do you call it?
Africa.
Kenya.
In Kenya.
I think
it's so nice to have everyone in Canada involved with this forum, which is great because being an American involved with American media kind of doesn't even talk about Canada. We hardly even hear about Canada in the news, and I have a lot of family up there, up in Montreal, some in Toronto. Getting back, Shan, let's talk about M-Pesa, what that is.
And just to let people know, we're extending this final session, aren't we, so that we can do a little
about
closing?
About 15 minutes, and then we'll call it quits for tonight.
Yep. Just so people know that it's not going to end in 3 minutes.
Yeah.
As was originally planned.
Thank you, Kathy and Diane, and thank you for Jackie and Suzanne.
And Steve, can you mute everybody now? Because we're hearing a lot of that background noise.
Yes, I'm going to mute everyone with the exception of the people who were on this session.
Okay.
Okay, meaning the moderators. Let's talk
on?
About this call M-Pesa. Shan?
Yes. I think that is the pioneering one that got started in Africa, and I think it's the one that was the beneficiary of the UK government £2 million investment in the programming done for Vodafone, I think it was, that used it. But it is the sort of poster boy of digital money. And as reported, there's now billions of dollars being transacted on cell phones. And the United Nations and officers from the World Bank have got involved in this. And they see it's a way of empowering to develop the economies to not just for money, but just for economic communications. Now, I'm not an authority of all the details. It'd be much interesting to get officials from the World Bank who I found on the webpage, and the people from the United Nations. They have conferences on these sort of things and promoting it.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it needs people like you to get it out there and give them airtime to learn from. It's ironic that we're learning from the less developed countries, so they provide an example of how we can break the monopoly funny money that governments print and enslave their citizens with the back-to-front system that we presently have. We've got back-to-front sort of money that earn interest instead of decaying, and we've got back-to-front creation of money with the private sector profit. For-profit private sector creating money to lend to the government instead of governments creating it on a non-profit basis to lend to the banks.
And now that we have a public dialogue about something called M-Pesa, that's in, my research shows it's in several countries.
So,
M stands for, 1 second, I'd just like to read this out loud for a moment. Kenya, Tanzania, Afghanistan, and South Africa. As early as 2009, plans to go to India and Egypt.
Well, this
is
terrific because
you think this is possible to go to come into America?
Certainly, and this is the great role model. This is what we've got to do. But earlier on, you referred to it as green money. As my understanding, it's not green money as I describe it. It's either informal units of account, like airtime, or it's the local official currencies. It's not necessarily tied to renewable energy, and that's what defines green money. Benign, cooperatively owned, benign renewable energy generators generating kilowatt hours for retail delivery. It's the retail delivery of renewable kilowatt hours that defines green money, and I don't think that has yet appeared. So we need to match the two up.
Is there anything else, Sean, that you'd like to mention?
Wait a second. I wanted to ask him about that. I'm wondering if you see a danger with this implementation of the digital money, that these companies like Vodafone, et cetera, could become like the banks, or you know, become the new banks and begin to start charging interest, et cetera, et cetera. Is there a danger of that? Because these are for-profit organizations, right? And they're like
Exactly. Everybody
else. They're thinking, well, okay, we're dealing with currency now. Why don't we start charging a little bit of interest?
Exactly. And this is I've had private offline conversations with Stephen about this very thing, that we've got to get public awareness of who should create credit and how money and credit should be created and who should create it. So while we're attacking the government in one way, we're looking for protection in another. But the best way is by leading by example and empowering the people from the ground up to do their own thing independently. And you don't get, if you get it centralized in any way, I mean, having a central phone company is just like central banking. We don't want to go to centralization. Nature is highly decentralized. And that's how you get resiliency against crisis, where the existing financial system is too interlocked. There's a huge interlock between U.S. banks and English banks and European banks. So if one goes, it spreads around the world. You know, decentralization in Vietnam managed to defeat the greatest power, economic power the world has ever seen. And this decentralization creates resiliency. And the same thing's happening in Afghan. It's decentralized rebels that can conquer centralized armies. Nature works on a decentralized basis, and we've got to empower people to look after themselves and choose that which serves the public interest.
Right. So we have conflicting interests happening because, of course, there's a huge desire to accumulate wealth and power, and that's why we have, you know, huge institutions that have these huge amounts of wealth and power. So, you know, that's going in one direction, and then the decentralization is another direction. So that's the challenge.
Well, there are people that want to do the right thing, that are very, very wealthy financially, that are doing the right thing, that have walked away from the corporations because they no longer felt right there. My buddy Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, resigned from Apple because he was getting tired of going into board meetings. He was just wanted to write code, and so he resigned. But anyhow...
And what were you going to say, Sean?
Well, there's another topic which is not on money but on power, and Rick, you've put your finger on it, and my academic reputation is based on decentralizing power of corporations. And that's a whole new topic, that some of the most successful, resilient, and efficient organizations aren't listed on stock exchanges because they're owned by their stakeholders. One of the biggest retail firms in Great Britain is called the John Lewis Partnership. It's owned by the 60,000 workers of it, and it's highly decentralized by store and has hundreds of boards. There are worker cooperatives and stakeholder cooperatives in Spain, around the town of Montrigan. Each firm has about five different boards, and there's hundreds of boards in the whole system. Visa International, the credit card company, before it was publicly floated a couple of years ago, it had the founding CEO, Dee Hock, said it had hundreds of boards. Each one had absolute power over one geography or one function. It followed the laws of nature, which combined opposites. He called it a chaotic system, because it combines chaos and order. And nature works in opposites, yin and yang. So we have contrary DNA breeds into us contrary characteristics to provide checks and balances on excessive power, and to learn how to manage unknown complexity to survive, to pass our DNA on. We've got this cancerous system of centralized power, of great wealth, as Rick points out, and we need to reinvent corporations so they follow the laws of nature, and I call them ecological corporations. But this is another whole new topic, which may be best left for another forum.
We can go to that. What I'd like to do is wind up this long, powerful forum right now, if that's okay with you, Shannon. You know, we'll certainly pass on all the questions to everyone. It's been a very long 2 days, a very wonderful 2 days, which will continue in next week. Shannon, I want to close in your session saying thank you. And there's a couple of people that I'll inquire about, I'll inquire to personally, people that might be interested in getting part of a venture that you've been talking about.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Shan. I think Steve and I are going to wind up our forum that we had the first weekend. But Shan, thank you so much for a really enlightening discussion. And this is just the beginning.
Well, thank you very much for providing the airtime. And let's hope that we can make new connections and empower people from the ground up to reform, transform finance, and liberate the world and sustain humankind on the planet.
There you go. You want to say your website and email address one more time?
I don't have a website. I use other people's. But if you just Google my name, S-H-A-N-N, first name Shan Turnbull, T-U-R-N-B-U-L-L, you'll find my writings and where my articles are. And mainly there's an academic website called the Social Science Research Network, SSRN. You'll find all my academic articles, but my popular articles are floating around everywhere. So please go and look for it or contact me directly. My email address is shan.turnbull@gmail.com is the easiest one. But I do have a lifelong Harvard address, which is sturnbull@mba1963, which dates me, .hbs for Harvard Business School, .edu.
All right.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much, Shan. And we'll be in touch during the week. Obviously, Rick and I would just like to sign off for the week.
And have a rest.
Weekend before we resume next week.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Rick?
Yes, so thank you, everyone. It's been very exciting. And don't forget, if you missed anything on the sessions on this weekend, you can go back there. They're going to be archived, and you can replay them. And then during the week, people who are members can write on the blog and interact with everyone else. And then next weekend we have an incredible lineup of folks, including Deepak Chopra and Desmond Tutu and Hazel Henderson and so many others. You can see on the schedule. So we're very excited to move forward.
Absolutely fabulous. It's been a fabulous, very fulfilling weekend for me. I wanted to thank Rick, all the affiliates, all the special guests, all the attendees, everyone from around the world for participating in the first global virtual conference ever of its kind. Thank you very much. We're going to end this session now. We'll see you all during the week and next weekend. Thanks, everyone.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.